Robert E. Howard's Conan sparked my imagination and inspired my play. I enjoyed the graphic artwork of Frank Frazetta, who splashed the covers of these fantasy paperbacks with heavily muscled, grim, sulking heroes, often adorned with nearly nude women of preposterous proportions. In elementary school, I did not enjoy math and science, but loved social studies, geography, and history. I remember vividly when our sixth-grade teacher, Miss Langford, taught us about the conquests of the Assyrians across Mesopotamia. I could not know, of course, that in 2006 I would be streaking across that very battlefield, yet again a war zone, but now called Iraq, in a CH-47 helicopter accompanied by U.S. Special Forces, in my role as the U.S. Ambassador and Coordinator for Counterterrorism. As I grew older, I plunged into books on intelligence practice and modern warfare. I remember The Thin Red Line, a novel by James Jones about the Guadalcanal battle. The pages were soaked with all the human emotions, horrible and heroic. There was also the escape and evasion classic of World War II, We Die Alone, by the Norwegian commando David Howarth, who endured impossible suffering. I was awed by his determination to survive, even cutting off his own frostbitten toes to prevent further infection and death. I read books about the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the wartime forerunner of both the U.S. Special Forces and the CIA. I read about Merrill's Marauders in Burma. And perhaps most important of all, I came upon The Craft of Intelligence by Alan Dulles. I still have the book, the first edition of the Signet paperback, printed in 1965. The pages are now creased and faded yellow with age. I saw Sean Connery as James Bond in the movie Thunderball. I sat in the middle section so I would have the center view of the screen in the small, worn Knox Theater in Warrenton, Georgia. The Bond character, imbued with almost pathological individualism, matched with unselfish government service, fashioned new dreams. His disregard for authority and his complete devotion to a mission, along with his cool creativity, offered a new twist to my emerging concepts of government service. But I cared less for Bond's social sophistication. After all, he was a Brit. Maybe I understood that, with my roots deep in the Georgia backwoods, I could never attain such cosmopolitan flair. Or maybe I never wanted the fancy drinks and expensive clothes. I did want everything else, and I was determined to achieve it. My parents and I watched the nightly network news coverage of the Vietnam War. We talked about the local boys who fought there. Some did not return. So many young men from the farms and forests of Warren County, Georgia, have not returned from our nation's wars. There are monuments in the town square dedicated to their service and sacrifice. One block of granite in front of the county courthouse is inscribed with the 154 names of Revolutionary War veterans buried in the county. This is an extraordinary number for a county so small. A surveyor, cartographer, forester, and woodsman, my father would often take me with him to work or to hunt. We would sometimes find abandoned cemeteries with sunken graves. The Georgia woods had reclaimed so many family farms, some with their own private family plot for their dead. Many still had headstones, some broken, some patchy with moss, and some so faded you could hardly read the names and dates. The long-forgotten graves, some of them soldiers, haunted and inspired me. The melancholy pride of unheralded duty and secret honor swirled around these sacred sites deep in the quiet forest. There was a history of service in our family. My father was a non-commissioned officer in the 101st Airborne for a couple of years. His four older brothers had all fought in World War II. All four of his paternal great-great-grandfathers fought in the Confederate States Army at the Battle of Peachtree Creek outside of Atlanta. My direct forefather, William Crumpton, enlisted in 1863 at age 43. On the muster roll, he is described as 5'10", with dark hair and dark complexion. He apparently could not read or write. For a signature, he marked an X next to his name. My grandfather, a Baptist preacher, was one of the first in his line to graduate from high school. He finished via a correspondence course at the age of 38. My father and one of his brothers were the first two Crumptons in our family to graduate from university. My parents emphasized the importance of education. A brilliant and determined student, my mother graduated from college at the age of 19. She immediately started teaching in elementary school, supporting my father, who attended the University of Georgia's Forestry School. They provided me every opportunity to learn. I loved to learn, and I studied with intensity. I attended a small public school with no advanced class, no honors programs, but good and caring teachers. I excelled in the classroom. I skipped the seventh grade. In the eighth grade, I wrote my first term paper. The subject was the Six-Day War, a stunning Israeli victory against its Arab neighbors in 1967. It was a brief war, a war won well before the combat began because of intense preparation and extraordinary intelligence. In adolescence, testosterone trumped childhood dreams, and I drifted away from the idea of national service and focused on more immediate and dubious adventures. I left home at the age of 16 with $100 in my pocket and my father's green army duffel bag. He gave me the money, and my mother gave me a tearful kiss. I loved them immensely, and still do, but it was time to go. There was a world beyond the classroom, beyond the piney woods of Georgia. I traveled west and found work in Alabama, working on a survey crew. A few weeks later, I changed jobs, working in a carpet factory, where I packed and hauled large spools of yarn. I was on the evening shift, so I could attend school in the day. The following year, after working 40 hours a week in the factory and attending classes, I left Alabama with a grubstake and a high school diploma. I continued to travel west. My first foreign trip, at the age of 17, was to Juarez, Mexico. I walked across the bridge from El Paso, Texas. I would return to Mexico often. Attracted to its great books program, I attended St. John's College in Santa Fe. But I was soon drawn by the extracurricular opportunities at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and I transferred there. In 4 years, I studied with a passion, political science, history, anthropology, and geography. I also chased co-eds, skied at Taos, practiced martial arts, and played rugby on the sun-hardened pitches scattered across the Southwest. After graduation, I drifted overseas, figuring that if I was so interested in global geography and international politics, I should acquire a better, more intimate perspective. I wandered and worked where I could, visiting New Zealand, Australia, Indonesia, Singapore, where all men with long hair had to go to the back of the customs and immigration arrivals line, Malaysia, Thailand, the Soviet Union, Norway, Denmark, Germany, Holland, and the United Kingdom. By the grace of God, I eluded law enforcement for immigration violations, smuggling, black market currency trading, violent public disorder, and other misdeeds. It was a great year abroad, an instructive, free-form introduction to global risk and reward. At the age of 22, I returned to the United States and again applied to the CIA, and again received a rejection letter. Polite and formal, the response enumerated my many shortcomings. The CIA instructed me to pursue an advanced degree, gain more international experience, and learn a foreign language, something more useful than rudimentary street Spanish or vernacular Australian. I secured a student loan, moved to the Washington, D.C. area, found a part-time job, and enrolled in American University's graduate school. After only a couple of months, unsatisfied with study and more determined than ever to be a spy, I acquired the address of a local CIA recruiting office in Roslyn, Virginia. I walked into the office unannounced and sat in the waiting room. A receptionist eventually greeted me. I explained that I wanted to join the CIA's clandestine service. She instructed me to wait. She departed. There was nobody else there. I wondered if I was being watched or filmed. It was eerie. A handsome black man, about 30 years of age, arrived to greet me. He used some innocuous first name as we shook hands. He described himself as a CIA operations officer, just back from an assignment abroad. After a couple of questions,